Sporty greetings to all of our Voice of America listeners. I'm VOA's Andrew Palcheski in Washington, filling in for Sonny Young. Welcome to the Sunny Side of Sports.
Stand up! Stand up! Stand up! Stand up!
Friends, we can all listen to the Sunny Side of Sports.
Yes, my friend.
The Sunny Side of Sports.
Sunny Side of Sports.
The Sunny Side of Sports show.
Great show, bro. This is Sunny Side of Sports.
Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.
Voice of America.
Stand up. Stand up. Stand up. Stand up.
We start today with a story we've been following on the Sunny Side of Sports for months. Back in August, during a National Football League preseason game, San Francisco 49ers backup quarterback Colin Kaepernick chose to kneel during the playing of the U.S. national anthem. Kaepernick, who is African American, explained, quote, "I am not going to stand up to show pride in a flag for a country that oppresses black people and people of color," referring to a series of high-profile incidents where African Americans were shot and killed by police. The move sparked strong emotion among fellow players and fans, ranging from praise and solidarity to scorn and anger. Case in point, at the same time that some fans were burning Kaepernick's jersey in protest, his jersey was the number one seller in the NFL's online store. 2 months later, we're in the seventh week of the NFL's 17-week regular season. Colin Kaepernick is no longer the backup quarterback for the 49ers, but the starting quarterback, filling in for an injured teammate, and he's continuing his national anthem protest. So let's take a look back to the September 13th episode of our VOA show, Hashtag VOA, when I spoke with several sports experts about Kaepernick's protest and its impact. And we start with Ebony McMorris, national correspondent with Radio 1, on why Kaepernick's protest resonates with Americans.
One conversation we had in particular that really stuck out to me, so many of us talk about having this love affair with the civil rights movement, and we've seen so many different interviews with people quoting Martin Luther King Jr. And one caller brought to mind, and it was so wonderful how they said, we talk about protests and demonstrations and what Kaepernick is doing because it is basically interrupting an environment where people have felt comfortable, which is Sunday night football, right? But if we want to look at the life of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., in his book, Letters from a Birmingham Jail, he said that he did the demonstrations to dramatize the issue that was going on at that time so that it can no longer be ignored. And from that conversation, many others called in and said they felt that it was the perfect platform that he used to dramatize an issue, which he had been doing before it got attention, I might add, so that it cannot be ignored. And what other night captures so many people at the same time then? Sunday night football.
But what about that criticism? Professor Barbara Osborne teaches both law and exercise and sports science at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and she sheds light on some of the backlash faced by athletes like Kaepernick.
Professional athletes have all of the same constitutional rights that any American citizen would have. The difference is that when you're a professional athlete, the backlash is very, very public versus just a person. And then the other aspect of it is that your behavior as a private person and an employee in a private organization is very, very different than a private citizen speaking out against the government. So the Constitution protects private citizens from interference by the government with their free speech, but it does not protect a private citizen or an employee of a private employer from retaliation by the employer.
And then there's the issue of reputation. Could Kaepernick's actions help or hurt his standing with fans? For that answer, we turn to Bob Dorfman of Baker Street Advertising, a sports marketing firm in San Francisco, California.
With every athlete, especially with social media these days, they're out in front at all times. We know everything about them. So basically, you would tell an athlete who wants to do something like this that you're going to be subject to a lot of criticism. You may alienate a lot of your fans or half of your fans. On the other hand, you're showing sincerity. You're showing honesty. You're showing support of a good cause. And I think all of that over the long run tends to make you more of a likable athlete, more of a marketable athlete, and somebody who gets more respect from the public.
And finally, we've heard from the experts, so let's hear from the man himself. Colin Kaepernick spoke with the press this week and explained why he's continuing his protest throughout the NFL season.
This is a real issue that affects many people. And, you know, it's something that has to be addressed. And until, you know, us as people recognize and address that some of us have privilege, some of us don't. And some of us are able to do certain things without consequences, and others of us can't. You know, those are all things that need to be addressed. You know, me as a black man that plays football and is on considered a celebrity, I'm treated differently than a black man that's working a 9-to-5 in the hood. And that's just the reality of it. And it shouldn't be that I'm treated differently than that person or he's treated differently than me. We're human beings, and that needs to be something that everybody's treated that way.
Kaepernick offered another reason why he's protesting, evoking one of sport's greatest civil activists, Muhammad Ali.
He was someone that he fought a very similar fight and, you know, was trying to do what's right for the people. And for me to be able to have someone like that come before me is huge. And he is someone that helped pave the way for this to happen. And what he did and what he stood for, you know, people remember him more for that than they do as a boxer. And that's, I can't let him die in vain. I have to be able to try to carry that on and try to fight that same fight until we accomplish our goal.
Colin Kaepernick and the San Francisco 49ers face off against the Tampa Bay Buccaneers this Sunday in Santa Clara, California. And speaking of Muhammad Ali, later this month on October 30th, the world will mark the 42nd anniversary of the Rumble in the Jungle, the epic clash in Kinshasa between Ali and then world heavyweight champion George Foreman. Ali knocked out Foreman in the 8th round to score one of the greatest victories of his storied career. But this year's anniversary promises to be bittersweet following Muhammad Ali's death on June 3rd at the age of 74. Former world heavyweight champion Larry Holmes is one of only 5 men to beat Muhammad Ali. VOA's Straight Talk Africa host Shaka Sali asked Holmes for his reaction when he found out that Ali had died.
Well, I kind of like inspected because, you know, a few months ago I was down there in Louisville with him, and he didn't look too good. And I said to my wife, I don't know about that. I said, I don't think he got too much longer. I said, he don't look good because he didn't talk. He didn't just sit there, just stood. And, you know, I was, like, worried, you know, and I didn't want to go back and see him again. But I went back and seen him again. It was still the same, doing the same thing. So, but I kind of expected. But one of the things about it hurt me. It hurt me because not only he was a friend of mine, but I think he was one of the greatest fighters ever lived in this world.
You happen to be one of the elite 5 boxers that, in fact, defeated at one time Muhammad Ali. But yet again, you happen perhaps to be a very unique individual, given that you were his former sparring partner, a friend, and of course, eventually a world heavyweight champion. What was it like to fight Muhammad Ali?
It was a good pleasure fighting Muhammad because, you know, he was my friend and he was my boss. And then I had to fight him, you know, but then it was the money thing, you know. If I beat him, I'd be the old man. If I lost, I never had anything. So, you know, my thing was not to take it hard on him because, you know, I knew how he would fight. And I knew that I could beat him. So I don't want to hurt Muhammad Ali because he is my friend. And so when we fought, you know, I told him, don't get hurt. Just don't go crazy. I did. I said, I don't want to hurt nobody. I don't want you to be hurt. And, you know, he told me, shut up and fight, you know. And I did what I had to do without hurting him, I think. I don't think I hurt him. And, you know, we remained friends because right after the fight, I went back to his dressing room and I told him, I gave him a hug and told him I love him. And he said, if you love me, why you beat me up like that, man? So, you know, he was a great man. And he wasn't angry with me or nothing like that because it was about the money. He got $10 million and, you know, back then, that was a lot of money, you know? So he was happy, and we remained friends even after the fight.
Any particular reason, Larry, why you cried after the bout? You don't seem really to have enjoyed the fight.
I don't enjoy the fight. He was my friend. He was my boss, you know what I mean? You know, he was a guy that helped teach me how to fight. I mean, when I first went with him in 1971, I was just an amateur. I was learning how to fight. And he gave me the opportunity to come to his camp and work out with him and learn from him. He gave me that opportunity. When I worked out with Muhammad Ali for the very first time, we went to Reading, Pennsylvania. He gave me gloves and shoes, everything to box with. And he gave me the opportunity to box. And when he boxed with me, of course, he gave me the black eye, right? He gave me the black eye, and I loved it. And I said, okay. He wanted to put ice on my eye, and I won't let him put ice. He goes, why? I said, because I'm showing this off Muhammad Ali hit me in my eye. I said, this is nice. I can show it off. And, you know, he told me I was crazy, put the ice, but I never put ice. And then when I got home, I bragged about Muhammad Ali boxing me and giving me a black eye. It was a brag. Yeah, I bragged about it.
Now, knowing him the way you did, and of course you have to be one of the few very unique individuals that do that, do you sincerely feel, do you sincerely think that it was necessary for Muhammad Ali to fight the last two fights? I'm talking about yours and the one of Trevor Babik in the Bahamas.
Yeah, well, Trevor Babik, he didn't need to fight, but what it was about was the money. It was about the money with Ali. He started fighting for money after he couldn't beat me. He just said, I'll take a fight with money. And I didn't like that fight. I didn't think he should have took it. But again, you can't tell people what to do because, you know, the man, when I do tell him that he's the champ, I said, shut up. He can do what he want to do, so I don't say anything. Well, if he was the champ, in my opinion, he was always going to be the champ. So, you know, the Berbick fight, the Trevor Berbick fight, Trevor Berbick didn't fight the Ali that I fought. If he did, he would have got beat.
You, again, happen to be one of the few people that interacted with him in a very special manner. What is it that during that experience, really, that you learned? What did you learn from him, and what did that interaction mean to you?
Hey, listen, I got the best jab in boxing. I had the best jab in boxing because of Muhammad Ali, because I tried to keep up with him. And when he threw the jab, I want to throw the jab. I want to beat him to the jab because everybody knew how Ali was. Everybody knew that he was a good jabber. He always jabbed right-hand combination. And I wanted to be like that, so I worked on that to beat him to the jab. And that's why I lasted so long in boxing, because I had a good jab. Everybody had to worry about the Larry Holmes jab. And then when they worried about the Larry Holmes jab, then they had to worry about the right. And so they couldn't do both. And I was able to win the fight.
What was it like being with him in Zaire back in 1974? I'm talking about the Rambo in the jungle.
In the jungle. I was there with him. I was there with Muhammad Ali, the Rambo in the jungle, in Zaire. And he trained good. I mean, you know, people love him. Ali Boumaye. Ali Boumaye.
Ali killed him.
Yeah. And, you know, there's all a lot of people that we that didn't speak good English, but they know how to say Ali Boumaye. We didn't know how to speak African, so we said Ali Boumaye. You know, we said the same thing, Ali Boumaye, Ali Boumaye. And it was neat. And people, everywhere you go, people love you. You know, they run after, they take little kids running behind the car, Ali, Ali, Ali. I mean, you know, it was mind-boggling. And you know what Ali said? He said, boy, he said, you're home. This is home, man. This is what our people look like. That's what we look like. And you know, he was very proud to be in Zaire. And I was just as proud as he was because I was with the greatest fighter of all time.
Any particular reason why the people preferred Ali to the champion himself, George Foreman?
George Foreman, though, it was okay boxer. But, you know, But George Foreman, they didn't like George Foreman. I mean, you know, because Ali, they loved Ali, they didn't like George Foreman. Because George Foreman wasn't no Muhammad Ali. Everywhere Ali go, people go with him. But George, they didn't do that with George. That's okay, because I didn't like George either.
I see. Have you been to Africa, Larry, since 1974?
I did not go to Zaire, but I've been to different parts of Africa already. Yeah, I've been to different parts.
What is it like to be a world heavyweight champion of the world? And you were for many years.
Well, it was an honor to be the heavyweight champion of the world. It's an honor to represent black fighters that could be able to do something. It would be great to honor white fighters if they work hard enough, they can be something. You know, it means something when anybody that work hard as I work can be anything that they want to be. You know, whether you're black, whether white, or orange, or green color, I don't care. If you work at something, you can always be that. Ali was living proof that if you work at it, you can be it. And he was one example. He moralized boxing, and he would go down as one of the greatest fighters of all time. And I'm just glad to say that I was one of the guys who helped him become one of the great fighters of all time.
That's former world heavyweight boxing champion Larry Holmes speaking there with Shaka Sali, the VOA Straight Talk Africa host, from his home in the eastern U.S. state of Pennsylvania. I'm Andrew Palcheski in Washington, filling in for Sonny Young, and you're listening to The Sunny Side of Sports on The Voice of America.
The Sunny Side of Sports welcomes your comments. You can send me email at sunny@voanews.com. Sunny is spelled S-O-N-N-Y. And pick up a pen or a pencil and a piece of paper. My full postal mailing address is The Sunny Side of Sports, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue Southwest, room 1613, Washington, D.C., 20237.
Joining me now in the studio is my VOA colleague, Doug Bernard, who's here to talk about the latest trends in the sports world. Sporty greetings, Doug.
Sporty greetings, Andrew.
And happy Friday also.
Happy Friday. And that was a great interview with Larry Holmes. I remember from my youth, because I'm of a certain age, Larry Holmes. So it was great to hear him again and great to hear his thoughts.
Yeah, absolutely. And especially in light of Muhammad Ali's death, a lot
exactly.
of people reaching out, even still months later, still talking about how great he was,
indeed.
Including Colin Kaepernick, as we heard.
Well, let's turn to things that people are talking about, I suppose, in the sporting world and things that are happening. First off, a very quick update. Now, I know that we've been updating listeners on the race for the World Series in Major League Baseball. Of course, last night, the Chicago Cubs handily defeated the Los Angeles Dodgers 8-4. I was watching something else, so that puts the Cubs leading the series now 3-2. They just need one more victory, and they're in the World Series. So that has people both excited and nervous, and this will make them even more nervous, perhaps. 538 is now predicting that the Chicago Cubs have a 51% chance of winning the World Series. That's more than a majority, and the Cleveland Indians are kind of far behind at 39%. So,
well, and you talked about yesterday the Cubs fans and how downtrodden they were, despite the fact that they're ahead in the series.
Yes,
there's still, you know, kind of this fatalist view that, oh, we're going to lose, we're going to mess it up somehow. Is that still happening?
Is still happening. I'm quite sure that this news is just going to kind of send them a little deeper into sort of angst and concern
the
and
anxiety
trouble.
Ratchets
anxiety.
Up with every win exactly. that they get closer.
Exactly. Some news for us here. The European Professional Football Leagues has said that it is ending its agreement with UEFA, the Union of European Football Association, and it is setting a March 15th deadline to either negotiate a new one or kind of break relations. Now, UEFA is, of course, a subset of FIFA, the global soccer or football authority. Now, basically what's happened is that the deal had ensured that the UEFA European matches weren't played on weekday evenings because those were protected by UEFA's Champions League. And what the European owners were saying, the European Football Professional Football League were saying, is we are completely not happy about this agreement. You've totally cut us out of the negotiations. And, you know, we're prepared to take matters into our own course because we, too, feel we want those audience. We want to go after those same viewers as well. So this, I mean, we'll have to wait and see. But just to alert listeners that this might be something in the future that really could change the complexion of how European soccer is played.
And it sounds like it goes back to the money, because with those games being aired, that means TV right. advertising, it means ticket sales, it means all that revenue.
Shocked. I'm shocked.
Shocking that anything FIFA or soccer related would be come back to money, but no, it's as it often does in sports, it is a revenue generating entity.
There you go.
And so that, I'm sure, is part of the reason behind it.
Well, let's take a listen to what people are talking about on Twitter. And no, not just because I'm a hockey fan, but history history was made last night in professional hockey in the NHL. Jaromir Jagr, maybe you may or may not have heard of him before. You probably have, being a New Yorker. He became only the third person ever in the NHL to notch 750 career goals. Now, if you think 750 doesn't sound like a lot, consider that the only other two players who have ever done it in the history of the NHL, Wayne Gretzky and Gordie Howe. And it's not for no small reason that Wayne Gretzky is known as the Great One and Gordie Howe, Mr. Hockey. So very quickly, Jagr, kind of a journeyman. He's played for eight teams. He's 44 years old, I believe, which is old for professional hockey. He's got total now about 18, just a little over 1,800 career points. Those are goals, assists, all that kind of thing. He says he's got lots of play left with him. Last year, I actually had the chance to speak with the Czech ambassador to the United States, Peter Gandalovich, and he said that, you know, Jagr is not only just one of the greatest in hockey ever, but he is a figure of national inspiration in the Czech Republic, and he actually likened him to how Muhammad Ali, this is last year, he was still alive, how Muhammad Ali is seen in the United States. He said Jagr is seen the same way in the Czech Republic, so really a national hero there. But one thing that Jaromir Jagr doesn't have is a good nickname. We talked about the Great One, we talked about Mr. Hockey. Jaromir Jagr, for some reason, has kind of slipped under, doesn't really have a good nickname. So Twitter, of course, is helping him out.
And how kind of them. I'm sure the suggestions are all very, you know,
yes.
Kind of fair.
And yes, exactly. So here's just a few of them. Mullet Man. Now, if you've ever seen a picture of Jaromir Jagr, you know that he loves his serious up front and party in the back hairdo. And he sports, at times, a very, very mullety haircut.
See, that could be trouble, though, because then if he gets the name, you know, dealing with the mullet, he has to keep that hairstyle,
exactly.
Conceivably.
Mr. Hockey Face is another one. Now, for those, if you've never seen Jaromir Jagr, he has a face for hockey. He looks like he's played exactly all of those career points and goals. Jagrmeister is one that's being thrown around. I don't know if people call him that. And then finally, Puff Nuts. Puff Nuts is actually Jaromir Jagr's nickname that his teammates and his friends call him. I can't figure out the origin of that, but Puff Nuts. Okay. So take that and do with it what you will.
We will probably leave it at that because I don't know if that's, you know, may not be safe for broadcast.
Right. As hockey nicknames go, that's actually on one of the tamer ones. So let's wrap up finally. This is something that actually you spied a little bit earlier. I started looking into it a little bit more, and I don't know if it's a matter that the NBA is going virtual or virtual basketball is becoming real, but the NBA has now officially partnered with a virtual reality company called NextVR, and they're making watching basketball at home almost like being there. Once a week this season, for 30 games all in all, the NBA will produce one broadcast in virtual reality. Now, you won't get it just sitting at home watching on your TV. You need some extra equipment. You need, like, you know, the goggles and the sort of the, you know, the extra box that it has to go through to get all this kind of stuff. But that's not really that much of a lift. But, you know, because imagine, I mean, say you're a basketball fan in, I don't know, Nigeria or Cameroon or the Philippines or wherever you may be. Chances are you're never actually going to be there on the boards watching a NBA game. And as you know, you know, when you're at an NBA game, you can be, like, practically right on top of the players. So this, the NBA is thinking, it's not just, you know, for viewers here in North America, or fans, I should say, but people around the world, because they've got a huge fan base, now can actually maybe get just a little bit closer to that real courtside feeling of being there during an NBA game.
And not to mention, probably in the U.S., I mean, those courtside tickets are
phenomenally
tens
expensive.
Tens of thousands of dollars.
Yes.
Was there any word if you'll get to see, you know, you'll turn your head and you'll see Drake on one side or Beyonce and Jay-Z on the other side sitting courtside with you?
Or Jack Nicholson.
Or the Lakers.
Exactly. You know, they haven't talked about that. The first game is going to be broadcast October 27th. So we don't know, but I betcha we'll be seeing a lot more coverage of that and seeing what it looks like.
All right, well, we'll have to keep our eye on that. Doug Bernard, thanks so much for joining us. And that wraps up our October 21st edition of The Sunny Side of Sports. Thanks to Voice of America producer Bill Werkinger, VOA engineer Peter Hundley, and thank all of you out there for tuning in. I'm VOA's Andrew Palcheski in Washington. It's been a pleasure filling in for Sonny Young. He'll be back with us on Monday. Have a good weekend, everybody. And that's The Sunny Side of Sports.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In October, the United States Agency for International Development, or USAID, and the Common Market for Eastern and Southern Africa, or COMESA, launched a 5-year Regional Development Objectives Grant Agreement at the 19th COMESA Summit, held this year in Madagascar. The agreement, announced in Nairobi, Kenya, provides for USAID to contribute approximately $77 million to strengthen the collaborative partnership between the two organizations and implement regional trade, investment, and agriculture development programs that contribute to their common goals. U.S. Ambassador to Zambia and Special Representative to COMESA, Eric Schultz, USAID Deputy Mission Director for Kenya and East Africa, Candice Buzzard, and the COMESA Secretary General, Ambassador Sindiso Ngwenya, signed a Memorandum of Understanding to affirm the agreement. Ambassador Schultz pointed to the continued momentum toward achieving common economic development goals by renewing the partnership. Through economic diversification, attracting more foreign investment, and reducing existing trade barriers, we can build upon our successes to date. I am confident that the new agreement will help us bolster growth and unlock economic potential among the COMESA member states. Under this agreement, COMESA and USAID will work together to achieve shared development priorities to promote sustainable regional economic integration, reinforce institutional governance and accountability by supporting the coordination of regional trade, investment, and agricultural policies, and strengthen COMESA's organizational leadership. The new agreement is not the first for USAID and COMESA, a regional economic community under the African Union with 19 member states. They have partnered since 2003 to create sustainable and integrated markets, increase the productivity of staple crops and farm productivity, promote trade and reduce trade barriers in regional markets, and support the free movement of goods and services in the region. Under a previous agreement, USAID provided $115 million to support the organization in delivering its mandate. The United States is proud to work with its partner COMESA to promote the prosperity of Africa and the world.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
With your ears on Music Time in Africa, your connection to the best Pan-African music. Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, inviting you to join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC. Every show brings you the best music from across the continent. Old songs you know and love, and new songs to discover. You'll meet artists, too. Listen to Africa's superstars and rising stars in exclusive, unplugged interviews on the radio or on my YouTube channel. Search for Heather Maxwell, Music Time in Africa. We play only the best right here on VOA Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, we'll look at the role of the Washington, D.C. Mayor's Office of African Affairs. We'll discuss the impact of the office as it seeks to improve the quality of life for the District of Columbia's diverse African-born population. That's next, right here on Straight Talk Africa at 1830 UTC.
Know the political process that determines who the next president of the United States will be? Tune in to VOA's extensive coverage of the campaigns, the voting, and the final tallying to find out how citizens choose their next president. Right here on VOA.